Mumong Khan, case 41. Bodhidharma faced the wall. The second ancestral teacher stood in the snow, cut off his arm, and said, "Your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, teacher, please put it to rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind and I will put it to rest." The second ancestral teacher said, "I have searched for my mind, but I cannot find it." Bodhidharma said, "I have completely put it to rest for you." Mumon's comment: the snaggletoothed foreigner came complacently 100,000 miles across the sea. It was like raising waves where there is no wind. Finally, he cobbled together a single disciple, and a crippled one at that. Barbaric. Shasanro does not know four words. Mumon's poem. Coming from the west and directly pointing, all the trouble comes from this transmission. The jungle of monks at sixes and sevens is fundamentally all your fault. Right. This is the last teisho of our session. Our schedule tomorrow is like this. We will begin our sōsan, doksan, with everyone coming in order in the early morning and continue in mid-morning. When this is over, there will be a chance for those of you who have something special to show, which came up during the interval after your doksan, to come a second time. Following this, we will have our closing ceremony and final tea with sharing. As I indicated yesterday morning, every breath moment is complete in itself and includes everything. There is no time at all. Today's case is one that gives Zen Buddhism a bad name, together with nonsense killing the cat and some others that are violent. Generally, it is important to understand that Zen cases are folk stories. It is important for us to see into the fundamental configuration of each one. Yastani Roshi, and in fact all teachers that I have heard give teishos on nansen killing the cat, declare that nansen mimed the action and released the cat. But for the story, it is important that nansen kill the cat. No two ways about it. Here it is important that Ekka Zenji, the second ancestral teacher, cut off his arm. Recently in Honolulu, we were favored with an exhibition of Sung paintings, Sung Chinese paintings. Was it Sung paintings? Or no, I guess it was post-Kamakura period paintings from Japan included in this exhibit. Was Sesshu's famous painting of this scene of Bodhidharma facing the wall, looking out of the corner of his eye, and Ekka Zenji standing there in the snow, holding out his hand with a towel wrapped around it. And there is the faintest red line around the stump. Something very endearing and humorous as well as profound about that painting and about that scene. Another thing to understand here is the element of mutilation in Chinese culture. And derivatively in Korean culture and Japanese culture. Self-mutilation as an expression of the utmost sincerity. From our perspective, it seems barbaric. But there it is. We have some barbaric customs, too. In my country, capital punishment, for example. In Honolulu, there is a Buddhist-Taoist syncretic temple dedicated to Kuan Yin. It's a Kuan Yin temple, right in the heart of the city. The nun in charge of that temple has the end of her ring finger missing. And many years ago, she told a group of us the story that she was an upper middle class girl in a Chinese family in Hong Kong and was determined to become a nun. And her family wanted her to marry a certain wealthy connection. And she refused, and they refused, and she cut off the end of her ring finger to express her determination. And it was that they relented. Well, that would be our reaction. Why was all this seemingly necessary in this early context with Bodhidharma? Bodhidharma came from India to China at an advanced age. I don't know how old, but some say over 90. With direct transmission from Shakyamuni Buddha. He was the 28th in succession from Shakyamuni. Possibly no Indian figure had come to China with such high credentials, such prestige. And so he was invited by the emperor to an audience. And this emperor, Emperor Wu of Liang, which was the kingdom of southern China at that time, was a very pious, devoted, and sincere Buddhist. The emperor said to him, "I have endowed hundreds of temples and monasteries and approved the ordination of thousands of monks and nuns. What is my merit?" Bodhidharma said, "No merit at all." Then begins the portion of the story that is given as case one of the Blue Click Record. The emperor asked, "What is the first principle of the holy teaching?" Now you might suppose that the emperor is asking here, well, if I don't get any merit for that kind of meritorious behavior, what is the first principle if it isn't merit? It's not that. The emperor was wiser than that. He recognized right away that here was a teacher who was pointing to the essential matter. And he could appreciate that there is no merit. So he is asking, what is the first principle? What is essential nature? What is Buddha nature? The way he phrased it was, what is the first principle of the holy teaching? Bodhidharma said, vast emptiness, nothing holy. So the emperor said, who is this standing here before me? In other words, who are you with your distinguished reputation, your fine robes, your venerable age, to tell me that the first principle of the holy teaching is vast emptiness with nothing holy? Bodhidharma said, I don't know. The emperor couldn't understand. So Bodhidharma left Canton, crossed the Yellow River, and went on to the province of Wei in northwest China. Later, the emperor took up this matter with his religious advisor, the Baron Shu. The Baron said, Your Majesty, do you know who that really was? The Emperor said, No, I don't know who that really was. The Baron said, That was the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, bearing the mind seal of the Buddha. Oh, the Emperor was remorseful and sought to have a messenger dispatched to have Bodhidharma return. And the Baron said, even if you send everyone in China after him, he will not come back. A wise religious advisor who figures in other cases in our study. Bodhidharma had some idea that possibly if he could help the emperor to realize essential nature as something more than philosophy, as something more than devotional practice, then the teaching would spread throughout the country. But it didn't work. And he knew that way was not going to work. So he settled down in a cave behind a ruined temple in northwest China and simply faced the wall. Now this wall gazing is not merely the act of shutting out the world. In fact, that is not the function here. If you have had a look at Mr. Sekida's book, Zen Training, you know he talks about Silver Mountain Iron Cliff as a particular samadhi condition. This is the makyo or vision of a wall that is directly before you, and you are pressing against that wall. This wall is mu. You are pressing against mu. This wall is yourself. You are pressing against yourself. And it comes closer and closer and closer. Nothing is static, of course, and that is a temporary condition. But somehow the practice of facing the wall, as we do in the Soto school, is one of tension and balance, the other and myself, the other as myself. Anyway, that was Bodhidharma's practice, which has been handed down to us. He wasn't accepting any students at that time. Ekka had heard about him and traced him and stood there in the snow outside the cave for a long time, begging to be admitted. And then finally, it is said, cut off his arm and offered it as a token of his sincerity. He could well, it seems certain that he had just one hand. This is independently documented. But whether he lost it then or not, we don't know. It's also said that Bodhidharma faced the wall so long that his eyelids fell off and he lost the use of his legs. Right? I don't know. So we don't know, but anyway, this is the folklore. So that he just didn't stand there in the snow, cut off his arm and say, your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. You know, there were long intervals here after he was admitted as a student, and then this dialogue, which is so abbreviated here, began. Your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, put it to rest. The creed occur of all Zen students. Yes. So, Bodhidharma. And notice he doesn't interrupt here the way Unmon interrupted his monk, but he picks up one point from the student's urgent request and speaks to that point. That is the salient point, he is saying, in effect. That mind is the salient point. What is the mind? See? When you see clearly what the mind is, then you yourself are at rest. So he was saying, in effect, bring me that mind and I will put it to rest. So probably there was another interval there. I don't know how long, maybe an hour, maybe a year, when Ekha Zenji says, I have searched for that mind, but I cannot find it. And Bodhidharma said, there I have put it to rest for you. That is the point. That is the crux, right there. Can you see any relationship there? Between Bodhidharma's words to the emperor and Bodhidharma's words to his disciple. Mm-hmm. I have searched for that mind, but I cannot find it. There, I have put it to rest for you. That is the main case. It's rather interesting to notice that, especially when going through the Denko Roku, that Ekha Zenji's disciple asked a rather similar question and got a rather similar answer. And then his disciple asked a similar question and got a similar answer. Denko Roku is a collection of Tensho stories, beginning with Shakyamuni Buddha and continuing in a direct line down to Dogen Zenji's grandson. Dogen Zenji's grandson or son? I don't forget. Let's see. Oh, Dogen Zenji's son in the Dharma. So, Dogen Zenji was number 51, and then it was his disciple whose story ends the book. And the collection was made by Keizan Zenji, who was Dogen's grandson or great-grandson. It's one of the books that we take up, so it's very interesting to see the progression of the lineage, our own lineage. And number 30 was Ekha Zenji's disciple, who is known in this book as Kanchi Daishi, went to Ekha Zenji and said, your disciple is suffering from a fatal sickness, said to be leprosy. I beg your reverence, please release me from my sins. Ekazenji said, bring me your sins and I will release them for you. The teacher sat still for a while and then said, I cannot find my sins in spite of all my efforts. And Eka said, I have already released your sins for you. You should live depending on the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's commonly believed and even said by modern medical authorities, not knowing what else to say, that bad karma is the cause of leprosy. It was certainly believed then. Kanchi Daishi believed that it was his sinful action in the past that had brought on his leprosy. Not quite the same kind of point, but very similar. Well, and then his disciple came to Kanchi Daishi, Dai Zenji came to Kanchi and said, I beg the compassion of your reverence. Please teach me the Dharma way of emancipation. The ancestor said, who is binding you? The teacher said, no one is binding me. The ancestor said, then why should you search for emancipation? Hearing this, the teacher had great realization. The gate of emancipation is open. Not two, not three. The path runs straight, Hakuin says. I used to think that Mumon Kan, translated as gateless gate, meant an impenetrable barrier. And you know, we have Yastani Roshi's calligraphy for barrier in our Doksan room. Gateless barrier does not mean impenetrable barrier, but a barrier that is completely open. Just the hint of a checkpoint there. You may pass through freely. The first principle of the holy teaching is vast emptiness with nothing holy there at all. And if you try to pin any of that down, Bodhidharma's words, I don't know, must echo in your mind. Well, Mumon's comment and poem don't take much comment. A snaggletooth foreigner came complacently 100,000 miles across the sea. It was like raising waves where there is no wind. What is the use of coming? We are all of us Buddhas from the beginning. Finally, he cobbled together a single disciple and so on. Yes. Barbaric. Shasan Ro does not know four words. Shasan Ro, Shibayama Roshi explains, and Yamada Roshi too explains, was a legendary fisherman who was very skilled at catching fish. didn't have much to say. Coming from the west and directly pointing. This comes from the so-called four principles of Bodhidharma. Oh, the first part, coming from the west, what is the reason, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? That's an echo of that. Directly pointing. No dependence on words or letters. Transmission beyond the doctrine, directly pointing to the human mind, seeing into self-nature and realizing Buddhahood. So-called four principles of Bodhidharma, which were composed some 500 years after his time, probably. It was quite a revelation to me when I looked up those principles in my newly acquired collection of Bodhidharma's writings, and there wasn't a single reference. The jungle of monks at sixes and sevens. I'm always amazed at my own students in Honolulu, who, too, a man and woman, don't know what sixes and sevens means. Our culture has become rather benighted, I'm afraid. People don't read. All mixed up, in other words, all confused. Fundamentally, it's all Bodhidharma's fault. Can we see our way out of that jungle in this session?